This is the third installment on our series of talks and dialogues about the Enneagram and how this particular typology is works really well with integral recovery. In fact, is an essential part of it. And serendipitously enough, Pam and I, when we were in graduate school, low many years ago in the late 80s, early 90s at JFK back in the Bay Area, we, the students of Helen Palmer, who it was the first time she was actually teaching about this stuff publicly. She just happened to be teaching our class. We had three quarters of class on basically on diagnosis and the Enneagram kind of melded together. So we were studying the DSM-3. Was it 3 back then? The Diagnostical and Statistical Manual version 3. I think we're up to 5 now, along with the Enneagram. And boy, it was just of all the things that I got out of grad school, besides a wife, that was probably the most enduring teaching that I learned. And the more it's just like the integral map itself. It's kind of a sub category of integral, but when you look at it just on its own, and of course using the other parts of the integral map to help you understand, the whole thing just opens up into just an infinity of depth and wisdom. And you know what, it's very interesting about integral in general, but you know, in integral, it's a methodology, a meta methodology or framework that allows you to just bring forth the baby in all these different fields of endeavor, and from you know, the richest historical wisdom schools, you know, the latest cutting edge science, all of that stuff, and brings it together in a way that for the first time in human history, I think we can really look at these things and go, wow, they're all a part of the evolutionary unfolding of the universe. And we no longer have to, pit religion, for example, or spirituality against science. There's just been so many things that are coming on board. And, of course, the spiritual leadership of the Dalai Lama over the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades has been really something. And one time he was questioned. He said, well, Dalai, you know, what do they call him, Your Highness, His Holiness? What is this thing? Anyway, dear Dalai, what would you do if, you know, science, you know, proves that some of the things you're teaching are wrong? And then he said, well, we would admit that we were wrong. We'd have to change what we're teaching. It was great. He says, we're not, you know, we're what we're pursuing here is truth, you know. And so it was like a real, you know, I think many religious leaders in the world would have become very defensive at that point. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the Enneagram touches us into a different type of learning, a different type of knowing, which is kind of interior intuitive wisdom. And the more that we work with these maps and models to understand ourselves and our clients, the deeper it takes us. And as with in any practice, you know, there's the exoteric. In other words, there's the kind of the outward, easier stuff that's quite simple to grasp. And then there's the deeper esoteric that requires, you know, deeper looking, deeper commitment, deeper practice to begin to work with. And both are, you know, both are valuable. You know, you can't say, well, the watermelon rind is not as important as the inner part of the watermelon. Well, you wouldn't have any inner part if you didn't have the outer part, which is another thing integral and Ken has taught us. You know, every exterior has an interior. And if you get lost in either one, you don't have balance and you're not being integral. So all that to say that this is really introduces an ancient wisdom tradition into the integral mix. And of course, we already have that because part of integral recovery is the deep contemplative inner practice that works on so many levels, especially with the new tools and technologies that the universe and we're bringing online at this point to help us really effectively do these practices, more effectively than was ever possible for the majority of us. So, the Enneagram is a different way of knowing, and it is extremely valuable in knowing yourself. And I think one of the, as it said in ancient wisdom school, in Greece, Elysian Mysteries. Anyway, it was Know Thyself. And so that is a very profound statement, because it can be taken at many levels. It can be know your ego, know your wants, know your desires, what you are, who you are. And then it goes to a deeper level. It's know thyself, you know, thyself with the big T and the big S. And it gets into the really deep spiritual realms. So the Enneagram is definitely a tool for that. And it will help us understand the small self, the ego structures, our own and others much better, and it will also lead us into the very depths of our own being and essential self if we keep using it as part of our practice. And I think it will save us decades of chasing our tails if we use this in our own interior exploration and working with our students. It just gives us a shorthand to understanding kind of the organization and the structures that are inherent in all human beings. So, Pam, do you want to add anything to that?
No, other than that, today what we want to focus on are the wings and the subtypes and the integration and disintegration movements.
Yeah, where you go and in what direction you move in when you're getting it together, when you're getting healthy, and what do you do under stress and when you're disintegrating. Very, very, very useful. And, you know, the book that I usually refer people to, which has been kind of my it's always there, you know, right next to my desk, is The Wisdom of the Enneagram with by Rizzo and Hudson. It should be all a part of your essential library, you know, kind of the books. If you had 10 books on your desert island, you know, what would you take? Might be one of those. And also, I think a student told me this the other day, well, what about The Enneagram Made Easy? And I went, oh, yeah, that's a great book. And so, and I'm not sure who the authors are, but The Enneagram Made Easy is the title. And it'll just, is really quickly and very clearly, I think, will help you identify what the particular points are. And it's a really good starting point for just getting the basic overview and a sense of who, what points you might be and the people that you're working with. So I'd recommend those two books. So, Pam, would you like to say a little bit about what we're actually supposed to be talking about, which are the wings?
Sure. So each point has points on either side of it, which can lend flavor to the point that you are. So, for example, if you look at the chart, and if you don't have the chart in front of you, if you go to the Integral Recovery Institute website and then look under resources, we put in there several Enneagram charts. And if you look at the chart, for instance, and let's say you're looking at the 2, you will see that on top of the 2 is the 1 and below the 2 is the 3. So those are the wings, the 1 and the 3 for the 2. John is a 6, so his wings are the 7 and the 5.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 9, and my wings are 8 and 1. And some people seem to be sort of perfectly on point, if you will. But others tend to have a flavor of, you know, the 1 or the 8, or for instance, in my case. So, for instance, I'm what's called a 9 with an 8 wing. I didn't start out that way, but I've certainly developed it over time. But that means that I've got kind of the core 9 aspects, you know, seeking peace and wanting harmony, everybody to get along, and therefore avoidance of conflict, that kind of thing. But because I have an 8 wing, it means that I actually have maybe more capacity to handle aggression and to be aggressive than your typical 9 might be. Let's see. I think that's kind of the main idea with the wings is, you know, to be aware that whatever point somebody is, they may have a flavor of something, you know, of a wing.
Yeah, and it's something you have to really kind of sense into also. And it's like, you know, I really think that I have a 5 wing, and everybody knows me think I have a 7 wing. So it's like, you know, on the exterior, I may seem like a, like a seven wing, six or the seven wing, but the way I feel in my own interiors feels like a five. And just as any other, body of wisdom, you have authors who will say different things about the same thing. And some authors who write very clearly and very usefully and very transformationally, and others just not so good. So you kind of have to really, pick and choose. And the two resources that I gave are really good. And of course, any books by Helen Palmer or any teachings also with Leslie Hershberger. I don't know if you've seen them yet, but we have these videos that we did about 6 years ago where we started talking about Enneagram and addiction. And that's just a field that we just began to scratch the surface of. And I hear rumored that there's a book being written or about to be published, but I haven't seen it yet on the subject. So, so the wings play into this quite importantly. And it just, as you begin to look at the Enneagram, you begin to see the kind of the deeper patterns and the real complexity that is built into the system itself. So, Pam, you have anything you want to say or any questions or comments
nothing,
at this point?
Nothing more on the wings, but yeah, does anybody have any comments or thoughts, or have you sort of sorted out which point you are and if you've got a wing flavor?
Yeah, so you lean towards one or the other, and who knows, maybe we flip-flop back and forth during our lifetimes. It kind of feels like I do that with the five and the seven. And then we wanted to talk about the directions of integration, mm-hmm. and the directions of disintegration. So in integral recovery, it might synonymously say the level of recovery and growth, and the level of stress and relapse. So that can really be useful in knowing when you're working with people or when you're working yourself. Uh-oh, I'm under stress. I'm starting to exhibit certain behaviors and thought forms are coming up for me. And usually, relapse is if we can go back and analyze it after the event, and we can see that it was a whole series of things that led up to our relapsing. And of course, one of the truisms that I built in or kind of emerged in the visualizing and creating and putting together integral recovery is that relapse begins when we stop practicing and not when we ingest a substance or whatever the destructive behavior, if we're talking about behavioral addictions. So practice is very important, and our practice, our integral practice, in other words, the body, the mind, the emotions, and the spiritual lines will, if stuck with as the master, as George Leonard said, the master is the one who sticks with the practice over the years, over the decades, and will lead us in the level of our integration. And if we stop the self-care, we stop our practices, and we just, rely on our own dumb luck, we'll probably go into the level of disintegration and relapse. And what happens when we stop practice? I mean, all kinds of things happen. If you have an unhealthy body, your less capacity to deal with stress. I'm reading a book called A Spark right now, and I can't remember the name of the author, but it's a doctor, and he just goes through and just lays out almost completely the upper right benefits of exercise. Then he goes through, and I'm not quite finished with it yet, but he goes through and talks about it, in the case of depression, in the case of addiction, in the case of ADHD, all these different disorders and sufferings, and how exercise is some cases more as effective, if not more effective, than other interventions, specifically medication, because he's a doctor, he comes out of the medical world. And it's all about the science and all the studies that have been done. It's pretty exhaustive and can be exhausting, but it's a great resource and really shows you why exercise is so important as a part of staying sober and as a part of being moving us in the direction of integration, evolution, waking up, sobriety, optimal health, creativity, etc. And it's got to be part of that. So when we don't do the physical practice, when we don't do the mental practice, you know, it's really clear to me that what we fill our minds with, in other words, the books we read, the conversations we have, the movies we watch, the music we listen to, are very, very powerful. And they act very much as intellectual vitamins. And there's let's see. Anyway, so if you fill yourself with really negative, stupid, you know, random, unhealthy communications, it's like you spend most of your time reading People magazine and listening to certain news networks whom I won't name at the moment. Yeah, you're probably going to have a pretty lousy, cynical, shallow view of reality, and that might lead to stress in your soul and stress in your mind, and lead you in the direction of disintegration and relapse, and in the case of addiction, possible death. Pam, you want to build on that?
Yeah. So just more specifically, the way that this works is if you look at one of the diagrams there that we've got, you'll see that there are arrows going in two directions from each point. So for instance, the six moves to, how does this go? Hold on a second. That looks wrong.
To nine.
The six moves to the nine under integration.
Or on top of integration, if you will. Yeah, when we're getting it healthier.
Yeah, so the six begins to trust more and question less, doubt less. And begins to connect kind of on a more whole level. And then the six moves to three under stress. And John, maybe you want to speak about that?
Well, yeah, let me start with the nine. So, you know, the kind of the loyalist soldier, the world's a dangerous place. You got to be strong. You got to be independent. A lot of the things that six, obsesses about. When you move to nine, I've noticed some shifts with me as I've been doing this integral practice over the last decade, is that sixes can be kind of intuitive, have a sixth sense, interestingly enough, because we're always scanning consciously and unconsciously the environment for threats. But I think nines have that in a different sort of way, because they have very porous boundaries. They can actually tap into fields besides their own mind and their own inner work. And so both sixes and nines, healthy sixes and nines, can make really good therapists. But I've noticed that that a kind of intuitive part of me has certainly come online more. And it's really, really useful when I'm doing working with people, counseling in a therapeutic role, that I can really sense into that. And more as I practice, I notice that comes online. And, for example, I was driving back from Texas, somewhere between Durango, Colorado, and Teesdale in Colorado still. And I was driving down the main road, and there was a car pulling up in another road on the side. And immediately I must have been 150 yards away. I said, these people are not going to stop at the stop sign. They're just going to pull out in front of you. And I just knew it. It wasn't even something I was thinking about. I just knew it. And sure enough, they did. And immediately I was prepared to brake and turn aside and everything. And just, whoom, I was ready for it. And because of that, because I had that center kind of being able to sense into that threat and kind of seeing the future threat before it was even really realized. And I don't know how that happened, whether I was picking up on their minds or their lack of consciousness or how that works. But anyway, and then when I got through that little mini crisis there, I wasn't nervous. My heart wasn't pounding. I was just like, oh, okay. It was just very natural. You know, the universe was looking at me, and the sixth sense was there and in place, and I just drove on without any real, trauma or like, oh, my God, I almost got killed and now horrible and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, and I've noticed a lot of times when I'm doing therapeutic work, I'll tap into that. I'll say, I'm getting an image, and go, oh, yeah, well, that was the dream I had last night. And I just pick up on that stuff. There's also another sense that I get from the nine that I've been noticing, is that it's a very kind of body felt knowing, and six is a mental point. So we analyze, I mean, we think about things, just how we approach reality. It's like we've got to figure it out. And the nine senses, I've really noticed in the last couple of years how I'm really tapping into my bodily sense. And if we're talking to somebody's business, this or that or the other, and my body's just gone, you know, just flipping out. I've learned to, or whatever it's sensing, I've learned to really pay attention to that and, you know, see what's going on there. And I may not know exactly what it's about, but I know there's something very important there, and the body doesn't lie. We may misinterpret it, but and the mind can get all garbled and confused, but the body's pretty clear. And a basic sense of peace. You know, when I was in my earlier years, if someday I'm going to put all my albums or my recorded songs, I think some are pretty good for everybody to download and listen to that wants to. But I was in a pretty dark green thing, and there was great fear about the survival of the planet and the survival of nature and other species and humanity. And I was pretty tormented by that. I think my music reflects that pretty clearly. But I've noticed as I've continued this walk, those things are still real and those things are still present, but I don't fear it as much. Somehow I have more faith that at the deepest level there's a perfection that's working through and there's an order that's coming through in the universe. And it doesn't get me off the hook of being responsible and acting wisely and being a part of the healing process, but it does take away just the crushing existential angst and depression and grief that I used to feel all the time. So
John, how does a three show up in terms of disintegration for you?
Well, in some ways it's good. And of course they said this may be ADHD too, but under stress I can really show up. You know, I can really get a lot done. And I used to do that in school. I would, you know, wait till the last minute and boom, you know, crank out the paper, you know, that was supposed to be done over a semester in just a few hours. So I can get really focused. I can get a lot done when I need to.
And what's the shadow side?
Shadow side is I'm a competitive jerk. And Pam knows that part of me well because we're tennis partners. I mean, we play each other. And that part comes out a lot, and I get to watch it, and it's really like, oh my God, it's pretty funny. And anything else you want to say about that, Pam, from your perspective?
Or did I cover it pretty well?
Or did I cover it? You know, competitive jerk. It's like, and you know, at the higher levels, when you're engaging in sports and competition, you are both. You know, you are the person you're playing against, and you're bringing, if you're playing well in your groove, you're even if you don't win the game, whatever that is, you're pushing each other to perform at a higher level, a higher physical level, a higher state of consciousness. It's just like when in lovemaking, at the higher levels of lovemaking, there's a dissolution of the individual boundaries and something, you know, greater than the self. You know, the individual is created sometimes, I mean, even physically, a child is, in the case of heterosexual sex anyway, is produced out of that. So, yeah. So, Pam, you want to talk about your, how you go in your points, being a nine, and you move to three when you're going in the direction of integration, and you move to six in the level of disintegration, how that plays out?
Yeah, sure. So with disintegration, when I get really stressed, part of the way the six shows up for me as a stress point is that I get kind of paralyzed. You know, I get paralyzed with fear and I don't know what to do or how to act. And that's one of the biggest things that I see with the six. And with the three, you know, it's sort of integration is about getting your act together. And I move from being somewhat slothful to getting a lot done and being focused and having lots of energy. So that's kind of a real quick snapshot of the nine. John, your dad is a one. And you like to talk about kind of that movement with him. So your dad goes to seven and to four.
Yeah. So my dad, you know, being the one, the judge, or the reformer. It says in some writers, in Rizzo and Hudson, they call it the reformer. So when he is, you know, in his unhealthy aspect, he's just really depressed and critical. you know, of himself and others in the world. And that's really, an unhealthy fair. A four goes there. And when he is getting it together, he goes to the healthy seven, and he's so delightful, you know. He's got a wonderful, warm sense of humor, self-deprecating, kind to others, and people will just tend to want to just be around him. The room will light up, and people will just gather around. Oh, Dad's on, you know, and there's just a beauty and a warmth and a delight that comes from when he moves into that healthy seven aspect. And it's not a narcissistic, wanting to steal the show or anything. It's just done in such a beautiful way that it's just a real grace and a gift to be around, which is the same gift that healthy sevens bring into the world.
Yeah, nice. So all the points have these movements. I don't know that we need to go through all of them, but you can at least get a flavor for that. Does anybody have any thoughts or comments about their point and their movement or questions?
Yeah, and the direction, now that you know this, right, you become responsible. You know, just like when you know about being sober and you know about the disease of addiction and you know you've recognized that through all your denial that, no, you really are hurting yourself and you really are hurting others, and you have the moral responsibility to get sober, okay? When you know this, you also get, I think it infers more knowledge, capacity, and it also infers more responsibility. So how do you move in the direction of integration and not disintegration is, well, you feed the good dog, you know, one of the the primary wisdom stories. You know, if you want to feed the bad dog, if you want to fill your body with crap, drugs, alcohol, bad food, lack of exercise, all of these things, yeah, that's not good. If you want to fill your mind with full of all kinds of, you know, paranoid, hateful, racist, just stupid, venal, narcissistic, shallow nonsense, yeah, well, you're definitely going to feel the results of that in your emotional body and your mental body and how you present and how you see the world. If you just deal with your emotions in an unhealthy way by stuffing them or projecting them or narcoticizing them or avoiding them, again, you're feeding the unhealthy dog, and you're building up stress in all your essential bodies and your essential parts of yourself, which will lead to disintegration and often relapse in the case of addiction. And of course, in your spiritual work, if you by avoidance of doing the inner work, by, you know, maybe getting lost in unhealthy manifestations of spirituality and unhealthy religions or cults or teachers or this or that. I mean, there's all kinds of alligators and pitfalls, you know, on the spiritual path that can also lead to a sense of defeat, despair, depression, grandiosity, narcissism, cynicism, and all of these things can lead to, what the hell, you know, doesn't matter. And you get a case of the efforts, and, you know, and you put all those four things together, and man, you're walking on really, really thin ice, and it's not so great. So yeah, so it's really, really, it's very useful. And one of the things, again, that recommends the Wisdom of the Enneagram book by Rizzo and Hudson is in each chapter it has examples of all the points and what they manifest when they're unhealthy in the level of disintegration, when they're average, kind of when you're just kind of hanging out in the middle, and when you're really healthy. And so you can read those aspects of yourself and go, oh, yeah, I know that one. You know, when I was really having that bad time in my life, or when I was using heavier, when I was in heavy avoidance, this is exactly what I was doing. And, yeah, this is kind of me on an average day. But when I've, you know, been doing the work, when I really show up for my life and for the world, this is what it, you know, what it looks like. And each of the points has its own kind of flavors, you know, of the light, colors of the light to give the gifts once you get there. And certain teachers have said that the more that we do evolve, the kind of hard it is for, from the outside for people to type us, go, oh, yeah, you're obviously a six, because we do begin to take on the healthy aspects of all the points. There's a deep integration that goes on at these higher levels. So that's a whole other conversation, but I think it's exciting because it gives a directionality to recovery and the journey. Oh, this is where this is kind of the promised land. This is what I have to look forward to, and this is what I'm starting to find as I put all these practices together and do the work. So just as developmental levels are really useful, so the developmental trajectories and progress inside the Enneagram are very useful and inspiring and help inform the journey. So we're just not kind of randomly saying, okay, I can't do drugs, but I can't stop either, you know. So yes, Pam, and what would you like to talk about next?
Well, let's talk about the subtypes. Those are the three main things. And then I actually like to talk about the subtypes a little bit and then talk more about kind of therapeutic applications, maybe even employment applications. But subtypes, there's three subtypes. We call them social, sexual, and security or preservation or any other names for that?
What's self-pres.
That? Self-preservation. Right. And so each point, say I'm a nine, for instance, also has a subtype that they tend to gravitate towards. So when I was younger, I was what's called a sexual subtype. And sexual doesn't mean sex. It means more intimate one-on-one relationships. And that was kind of more my focus. You know, I would have one best friend or just sort of, you know, I tended to emphasize more my one-on-one relationships with people, probably in part too, because as a nine, I'd get overwhelmed with, you know, lots of people in a social setting. But so the sexual subtype is focused on intimacy and one-on-one relationships. And the social subtype is focused more on the community, the group. That tends to be their orientation. You know, they'll typically be more extroverted, for instance. Whereas the sexual subtype will tend to be more introverted. And then the self-pres or security subtype is focused more on you know, self-preservation. That'll show up more in terms of am I safe, survival, money, you know, kind of like basic sorts of things. And I would say that I think that unlike the point that you are, which I think is fixed, I don't think you're a nine for half your life and then you're an eight for the other half of your life. You know, I think once you're a nine, you're a nine. I think the subtypes can change. I certainly see that in my case. I started out.
What have you changed to?
I started out as a sexual subtype, and now I'm more of a security subtype. I'm kind of more focused on, you know, security issues. And that's, you know, it's where my energy and my fear sometimes can arise from, that kind of a focus.
Yeah, and I've seen that, you know, and some people, when they say sexual subtypes, sexuality is such it's a loaded word and it has so many different meanings and different schools of psychology, et cetera. It's a one-on-one subtype. And I see myself as more as a one-on-one or a sexual subtype, and I'm much more comfortable with one-on-one conversations and relationships or small groups of people, and the whole big the group thing is like it's not my deal, you know. And sometimes in my work, people want me to do couples work or family therapy, and do I ever feel inadequate? Because I was just never really that interested in it. So I don't think I paid that much attention when I was in school, and I somewhat avoided it. And actually, sometimes I seem to do a pretty good job. That's just because the intuitive nature. After a while, when we're working with people, you kind of just sense into what needs to be done in the moment. And I'm very much an intuitive, and I fly by the seat of my pants, and often don't have it all planned out at all. And it's very interesting working with on projects with Leslie Hershberger, who is a seven, and one of the titles for seven is the ego planner. So they're really, really planning, you know, and like when we teach a class together, she'll have it all, you know, outlines and blah, 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 all this stuff. And I'm just like, hey, well, this we're basically going to talk about. Let's see what, you know, the universe unfolds through us. We know our subjects well. And so anyway, I'm one extreme and she's the other. And I think there's probably a really, you know, healthy in-between spot that would be good for both of us. So, yeah, so that's how that that plays out. And like when we were in we went to the Integral European Conference in Budapest, and one of the who's become a good friend now, the guy said, actually we started this relationship before the conference, but his name is Bence Gante, and he is a Hungarian psychologist and leader, and he's just fantastic with doing, you know, working with the energies and dynamics of big groups. And I just stand in awe because that's just not, has not been my focus. And I really don't want to do it, quite frankly. So that's another way of understanding and looking at your own inner dynamics and the dynamics of the people that you're working with. And if you start to do a, you know, as we used to do in some of our therapeutic work when we were doing wilderness or residential, we would do family, what do you call them, the family maps or diagrams we used to do, Pam?
Family sculpture.
Sculpting, yeah. And so if you would start looking at the different relationships, but if you also include the Enneagram points, that if you know the Enneagram points of your siblings, of your parents, your grandparents, boy, there's just a whole wealth of information and understanding of the inner family dynamics that can come out and help you to understand yourself, basically, is how you were influenced by all these different strategies and things that people were putting on you, either from, you know, wherever they were at developmentally, doing really well or average or very healthy.
Are you talking about a genogram? Is that what you're talking about? That's where you chart it out, like the family relationship?
Well, I was thinking more about the family sculpting. But, okay. Yeah, the genogram might be really useful, too, if you can.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah, it would be. So, I mean, you know, this is all open for evolution and developing. And, like we are living in the golden age of the Enneagram. And there's a lot of people working with it. And there's the whole the school of Helen and Leslie, which is a little different from the school of Rizzo and Hudson. And they are the what do they call themselves? The panel?
Narrative
tradition. So the way they figured out, which is really cool, you get, you know, a bunch of people, or, you know, five or six people or eight or nine, however many you want, that are self-identified at a certain point, and then the speaker, the coach, will ask them questions and make comments about how they approach reality, and then of course the audience can look at them and go, oh, start understanding deeply the point, or relating to how they have some of the same issues or might be the same point, and they get to ask questions. So it's really a spontaneous evolving body of knowledge, and the narrative tradition really helps that.
Yeah.
But
I just want to jump in and say, you know, we just actually, when we sent out the Integral Recovery newsletter, we put a link in there for Enneagram Maine, the state of Maine. But the guy that's kind of the leader of that, his name is Michael Naylor, N-A-Y-L-O-R. And I think I haven't found anybody that's doing more to develop really the Enneagram and addiction recovery than he is. He's been slowly writing about each point, what they look like, you know, the challenges in treatment and in recovery. So I highly recommend checking out his website. It's kind of it's not a great website, but some of the content in there is really stellar.
Guys, cool. I have a question. This is Hamlet. Going back to what you were saying about disintegration, I'm a little bit confused. Like, let's say I'm a seven. I thought I was a three, but when I started to really read wisdom of the Enneagram, I'm like, this doesn't sound like me. And a seven really, really did. So as if I'm coming from a very unhealthy stage and I have thus disintegrated to a five, what does that mean? Have I disintegrated to an unhealthy five? Have I disintegrated to a healthy five? Because that's almost an insult to the five then. Almost feel like, well, you know,
unhealthy five, Hamlet. Yeah.
No. Wait. Hold on. A seven, when they're integrating, goes to five.
No, disintegrating. Right? Hold on. Let me look at the chart.
At least the chart I'm looking at is the opposite.
The chart I'm looking at has the line from the 7 going down to the 5.
Hold on, let's see.
But the, yeah, but the
now five is security. It is. It's, yeah, five is the integrating point for the 7. I know what? That the arrows are kind of funky.
Okay, they maybe I'm looking at the wrong diagram. Under Enneagram resources, mm-hmm. which one am I looking at? Directionality, stereotypes, values, or centers?
You can look at the directionality one. You can look at the stereotypes. But I think the directionality one, anyway.
This is Victoria, and I'm looking in the Rizzo and Hudson book.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, for disintegration, scattered sevens suddenly become perfectionistic and critical at one.
That's right. They become one.
And then the direction of integration, gluttonous scattered sevens become more focused and profound like healthy fives.
Yeah. So
Hamlet, does that make sense? I mean, does that fit for you?
So it's the unhealthy side of each point is what the disintegration tends to gear towards. Okay.
Yes.
Exactly. So you become critical. My mom's a 7. And when she's unhealthy, she gets really hypercritical of everybody around her. And when she's in a museum, which is her place of, you know, solace and curiosity and stuff, she becomes very even-tempered and the wise self shows up.
Yeah, and I got to push her around in a wheelchair through the New York Met and Museum, and it was wonderful. I just was so happy to be with her because she knows so much about art. And she's cared about it for so many years. And so she was just downloading it to me. And I just kept my mouth shut, you know, and ask a question now and then. And so, yeah, so in the your healthy aspect, you'll take on the healthy aspects of five, which is kind of the wise sage. You know, Ken Wilber is a really good example of, of the healthy kind of wisdom, the big 50,000 foot altitude, you know, vision of things. And it's really good to have, you know, in your organism, healthy fives around, because they can really see deeply and they can analyze, and it becomes a real path to wisdom, to knowing.
Hamlet, you know, I'm wondering, can you apply this to yourself? Can you kind of see a little bit?
I'm trying.
I
know that the 7 on the chapter on the 7 was a lot like me. I identified a lot with it. Now I'm just trying to understand how, when I'm functioning on a healthy level, I'm functioning then on a 5 healthy.
That's exactly it.
7 and 5. I mean, there's a healthy 7. It's just that it's the expression is going to have more of a 5-like flavor to it.
Yeah, but you take on the aspects of the healthy 5 to help you be a healthy 7.
Okay.
You know. You have to play with this for a while.
And you take on the unhealthy, you know, the critical judgment, not just critical of others, but critical of yourself and blah, blah, when you move to disintegration towards one. Yeah.
Okay. So I would never take on a healthy 1. It would always be an unhealthy 1.
Well, you know, I read a book a while back. this is kind of, you know, going against what most of the teachers will say, but just to make things a little more complicated. This particular author said that we could move in healthy ways towards both of the points. You know,
that's
in other
the
words, you could
made easy actually. Definitely.
Really? Yeah. Okay. So, and I know some teachers would adamantly disagree with that, but I've kind of played with that in my own case, and I could actually see how that would work. You know, because under stress, I do sometimes take on the healthy aspects of 3. I can kick ass and take names and get a lot done. For example, the last two to three months, I've been staying with my parents who are aging. And for quite a while there, I was the caregiver. So I was preparing the meals, cleaning up, running the errands, getting to the doctors, taking the doctor's office, all the stuff. And I really noticed how super well I could function. You know, I just get organized in the kitchen, and man, I could whip out meals, good meals, in no time and get everything cleaned up. And I go, God, this is me? You know, this doesn't feel like me. And anyway, so I really shifted into what, to me, felt like, you know, the doer, the capacity of three kind of kicked in a healthy way. So I, you know, there's a real good argument to be made for that also.
Okay. Any other questions on this, Hamlet?
No, thank you.
Now you're thoroughly confused. Well, that's what we're here for. So, Pam, you were talking about, we don't have too much time left, but you're talking about maybe, and by the way, Pam was a clinical director for many, many years and a really super respected one in her field, which was wilderness therapy for many years. And so she had tons and tons of clinical experience dealing with families, individuals, addiction, et cetera. So maybe you could talk about some of the cases or at least one anecdotal story of how working your knowledge of the Enneagram helped you work with individuals.
Yeah, sure. Well, I hope to get maybe a couple of stories. And one of the stories was I was working with a client who was a seven with a eight wing. And the seven's kind of core mission is really to bring joy and play into the world. Like that's really important to them. And when they're on point and doing well, they are wonderful to have in a group. You know, they're kind of the life of the party. But in working with this young man, he was doing a lot of aggressive stuff that was actually causing people to push him away and be scared of him. And when I was able to sort of help him see how he wasn't accomplishing what he really wanted by working with the Enneagram, it really was kind of an aha moment for him. Because deep down, what he really wanted was, to bring joy. And so one of the ways that you can, one of the great tools about working with the Enneagram is it helps people look at their defense mechanisms and, you know, behaviors that are not sort of in line with what's really important to them in a way that they can see it. It's one of the things I love about the Enneagram. We can kind of look at ourselves and help other people look at themselves with less defensiveness because it's sort of, you know, it's like a pattern. You know, we can kind of objectify it a little bit. So I find it useful in working with clients that way. Also, I think I mentioned this earlier, but it's also helpful if you've got what we call, you know, kind of negative responses coming up to somebody that you're working with. We call it countertransference. And so, you know, if I've got somebody, for instance, part of my countertransference for another nine is that I get bored by them. So if I'm talking to somebody, a client, and I notice I'm having trouble being present and I'm getting bored, I'm going to start thinking, I wonder if they're nine. and then, you know, so part of that becomes me sort of witnessing that and then not getting kind of sucked into that. Nine's belief is that they're not important, they're insignificant. So they kind of reinforce that by not being present and not showing up and saying what's really true for them, all that kind of stuff, which can lead to people being kind of boring. And then the last thing I was thinking about was, this was more has to do with teams that you're working with, but we had a Enneagram 8 show up for a job interview. And in the wilderness, the job interview was actually like a 9-day affair where they went off camping with a group of other field guide applicants. And this person had her master's, was working on licensure, and was really very, and had tons of wilderness work, so it was very promising. But when the group came back 9 days later, I had like almost a line of people in the office wanting to talk to me. And I'm not sure who got in there first, but somebody got in there before she did and said, you know, this person's just not going to work out. She just was oppositional and difficult and rude, and it went on and on. And then the actual person comes into my office, and I'm talking to her, and I said, well, how was it for you? And she said, oh, I think it went really well, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, actually, what I'm hearing is it didn't go really well. And she said, darn, I was trying so hard to just stay hidden and, you know, be cool. And I had to laugh because many eights, you know, they can't hide. They're so obvious, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody's sort of getting reacted to them because they tend to be more concrete and blunt and don't follow all the sort of niceties at times. But what I found fascinating was I really wanted to hire her because I wanted her ability to be direct and be confrontive because of the clients we were working with, at least certainly some of them. But our organization was so, well, I want to use the word green, but, you know, kind of love everybody, don't rock the boat, don't challenge, all that sort of stuff, that I realized that that this organization probably couldn't hold her, that it wasn't a diverse enough organization.
A mature enough organization.
Yeah. To really use her skills effectively and you know, work with the challenge areas. So we had to turn her down. But the cool part of the story is that later I then worked for another organization and we were able to bring her in and really make use of her skills in the field and work with the challenges that she brought to the, you know.
Yeah, and they, the HL often, you know, working in the Wilderness Center, they were great with working with your really defiant, acting out difficult kids. I mean, they could just come in and, you know, be the drill sergeant, cut, kick butt and take names and whip everybody in shape and give, you know, these defiant acting out kids a sense of structure and security that they probably didn't have before. So you can really utilize the gifts of the eight. And I used to have just real major, maybe a little bit, but not as much as before, countertransference issues with eight. I'm a, you know, counterphobic six, and I want independence, and I don't want anybody to be bullied, and, you know, I'm this, that, and the other. I'd run into eights, and they were just like, immediately, I just want to get in a fight with them. And then I started having eight clients that the universe was bringing, and I remember I was at a conference, I think it was Helen Palmer was talking, and she said, you know, thing to remember about the eights, and she has an eight husband. She's a six, by the way. And, she said, you have to realize that all that bluster and force is just there to protect their oh-so-sensitive interiors. And she said, the gummy bear interior. And I went, oh. And something just kind of started falling into place with all my experience with the clients and one particular client I was working with at the time. So I went back there, and it just kind of reinforced my intuition of what that was, and to help them get in touch with their own sensitivity and really, you know, their own sense of vulnerability that brought on the whole eight structure of just that powerful, you know, just crush the opposition sort of approach that the eight has to life. Mm-hmm. So it really, really shifted things for me. And a former colleague who was an eight that I kind of struggled with, he was kind of a friend, but more off than on, since I kind of shifted myself, we've become pretty close as friends now. So it's not only just healing your own point, but you're healing your relationship to points that the universe will give you opportunity to work with people that are close to you or working with you or in your family or whom you work with as a therapist or a coach or whatever your role is.
Cool. So we just have a few minutes left. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Well, this is Victoria, and one of the things that I've become aware of, I haven't worked a lot with the Enneagram, but I find it fascinating, and I find that there's a real subtlety to it as well. For instance, I'm a one, and a lot is said about being judgmental and critical and that kind of thing, and people tell me that I'm one of the least judgmental people they know, but I can see in the interior how those things come up, but I don't express them, and particularly how my tendency is towards self-criticism.
Yeah.
Well,
and
then
so, you know, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you'll find that some ones tend to be more internal, and you would never kind of know they're ones because they're busy beating themselves up. They're not projecting it out into the world. It sounds like maybe that's more your leaning.
And Victoria,
it's really pretty.
No,
go ahead, John.
Okay, I was just going to say, my countertransference historically with ones were is like, oh, my God, a one. My dad's a one, right? It's like, boy, they're going to see what a mess I am, and I'm not going to stand a chance around these people. And then I would quickly, you know, my kind of intuitive, paranoid, sick self would go, well, are they an outward-directed one? Are they criticizing the world around them, or is it directed on themselves? And as soon as I find out that was all directed on themselves, oh, they're too busy beating on themselves to beat up on me.
Go ahead and beat yourself up. Just don't beat me.
You know, but the good point of, you know, the healthy one, you know, they have the wisdom of Solomon. They're that person is like, man, this is a really complex situation and we don't know what's going on. You get a healthy one and they can really, you know, they have this great wisdom. Whereas the five is more like, the path of learning and accumulating, you know, and being able to put it all together like Ken did. Integral map, for example, though the one is a different sort of, it has a different taste to it, a quality, but there's great wisdom and great sageness there also.
I would say that the one probably has more of a capacity for discernment, that's a difference between, say, a one and a five.
That's very true. Good point. Yeah.
Victoria, was there more you wanted to say about?
No, just that. And I became even more aware of it as I'm listening to you today, just how. And that's a very helpful distinction between the inward and the outward.
Mm-hmm.
But just aware, too, of the subtlety of it. It's not really blatant. But when you go looking for it, and it took me a while to really discern what I am. But when you do figure it out and then realize that it doesn't have to be really blatant, it can be quite subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the more we do, you know, that we do the inner work and the contemplative work, that which was before not clear, kind of in the shadows, becomes very clear. And we begin to understand it and the subtleties. And I was just thinking when you're talking about the subtlety, that's so true. You know, it's like music. I play the guitar and you can play a series of notes or a riff, we call them, and you can hit all the notes right and they're completely like dead. But with subtlety and nuance, anyway, I mean, it's just all embedded in practice and mastery. The deeper we go, the more that we become aware of the nuances and the subtleties, both in ourselves and out there in the world, and we're able to, you know. Oh, and an important thing for one, because an unhealthy one tends to be a very black and white thinker. You know, it's this or that. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's no. As you're speaking, the voice of a one that's done some work on themselves is that you begin to notice the subtleties and the nuances. And, you know, there's not just this and that. I mean, there's multiple perspectives and things going on. And being able to bring those all together in some semblance is the path of wisdom and integration.
So you think maybe I'm headed in the right direction?
Well, I really like it. And you really excite me. You know, We've been meeting with our, I don't know if I'm supposed to out this, but, you know, having our weekly conferences and students, and it's supposed to be a half hour, and it's always been like, you know, an hour. We just get going. There's just so much to talk about, and it's been such a, just an illuminating conversation and relationship. So, well, excellent, everybody. I think it's about time to wrap it up, and your professor and my dear friend and colleague, Guy Duplessis, will be arriving at our home any moment now. So that's very exciting.
Oh,
and love Guy, and I've hung out with him in person a few times, and I just really look forward to our connection. So we'll keep you guys posted. Work hard, study hard, you know. Because
have a wonderful time.
Thank you, Victoria. And Hamlet, thank you. Also for being here and just working with us.
Thank you. Keep us posted as to what you guys develop and come up with tonight.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
I wish you a great time. Yeah.
Okay. All right, everybody. God bless.
Thanks.
Bye, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.